Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thanks so much for joining us here on the program. It's great to have you with us. We come your way every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific time. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We also rebroadcast on a2zen.fm. You want to check their listings for the time and day. And we also archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page. So we encourage you to check out our guests and what they have to offer you in the way of information and insight. All that good stuff. I think that it would behoove you to find out more. Today, we have a returning guest. I'm real excited about this because I liked his first book, and now he has some new material, some new information, some new insights into what's going on and what's happening and what will be happening. Peter Canova is my guest. He is the author of Pope Annalisa, and also you have some other works we're going to talk about here on the program. It is also this book, Pope Annalisa, has been turned into, and like I'm surprised when I saw the book, I'm going, movie. It's going to be a movie here shortly. Thank you so much for joining us, Peter.
It's nice to be back again, Richard.
I have to say that we've, of course, had your wife on at least one occasion, maybe twice, and very interesting to talk with her. But what I'm most intrigued about, and we're going to touch upon both the early book, Pope Annalisa, but also you have some new works that are out there, and they are dealing with, I think some very, very interesting subject matter as well. But maybe give us a Cliff Notes. I don't even know if people know what Cliff Notes are anymore. Version.
I do.
yeah, well, so do I. I never used them, but I knew what they were for. So that's why I never used them, because I knew what they were for. tell us a little bit about, give us a Cliff Notes version of this incredible story, which I have to say, when Pope Francis was elected, and then I started hearing some of the things that were coming from him, I'm going, I like this guy. He is he is the people's person, you know? Just incredible. And I'm thinking, Pope Annalisa, first female pope. I could live with that.
Well, you know, it's funny you should mention Pope Francis, because the Om Times magazine did an article on all the kind of predictions relating to the Catholic Church. There were many predictions in Pope Annalisa's geopolitical predictions that kind of came to pass, but in specific, they dealt with the ones that had to do with the Catholic Church and the advent of Pope Francis, and there were some amazing parallels. Now, Pope Francis is not exactly Pope Annalisa, but he's probably the closest thing that you'll find to it in terms of what the Catholic Church will allow with its hierarchy and its leadership at this point in history. But I think Pope Francis is probably a good early indication that one day we will have a Pope Annalisa. So to get to your Cliff Note version of Pope Annalisa, it's really part of a trilogy called the First Souls Trilogy. And the First Souls are really kind of what it implies. It's the first souls to fall into the material experience from the world of spirit, from the higher realms of spirit. And the trilogy traces the lives of these characters as they incarnate over different epochs of time. And the first book, Pope Annalisa, deals with an African nun, a miraculous African nun, who initially is under investigation by the Catholic Church for miracles she's performing that haven't been seen in 2,000 years. And through a series of circumstances, she actually rises to become the first female cardinal and then the Pope of the Church. At that point, all hell breaks loose. The world is kind of going down rapidly, and many people are blaming her. So there's a real question throughout the entire book whether she is really kind of going to be a force for the progression of humankind or the destruction of humankind. And it's kind of up to four people to learn the secret of this female pope and what she's all about. But really, the book and the trilogy itself has to do with the origin, destiny, and purpose of humanity. And to that end, I actually wrote a series of nonfiction e-books, which two of which just came out in the market. The series is called On the Origin of the World, and the first two books are Children of a Greater God and A Descent of Light. And the series is really kind of a tour de force, looking at the deeper questions of life from the origin and creation of the material world and humanity, all the way through sort of kind of predicting where we may be heading. And it has to do with ancient spirituality and quantum physics. And it takes these two poles of science, objective science, and subjective spiritual experience as kind of yardsticks to create an arena of information to give the reader some really fantastic knowledge about things that they you know may take for granted, like what's the meaning of light, what does light really mean, what role does it play in our life, how quantum physics was really predicted 2,000 or 3,000 years ago, all the major theories by some of the mystic sages such as the Gnostic masters. It's a very fascinating book, and I think it'll help everybody's spiritual practice with looking at the whole breadth of information contained in the series.
I am always intrigued by this kind of stuff. By the way, there was one thought that had occurred to me many years ago, because I was talking with people and we were discussing pollution and trying to take better care of the earth and this and that and the other thing, and I walked away from that thinking about all of the different elements that we need to live. And we've polluted our water, and we've polluted our air, and we've polluted our food supply. But there's one other element that is required for life, and that's light. And what I found was, and this is a fine distinction, granted, you can't pollute light. You can diffuse it, you can block it, you can interfere with its flow, but you can't pollute it. It's unpollutable, if you will. Like, you know, if you can get the blockages out of the way, you're good to go, because we need sunlight to survive. I mean, I think without it, yeah, I think we'd have a feeling that some would say we'd go crazy and annihilate ourselves because we couldn't handle the depression and so forth that seems to come. But light and sound are, and maybe along the same line, sound, you can't really pollute it. You can make some strange ones, but it is what it is. And I want to talk a little bit about that in terms of what you're opening up. I don't want to use the term Pandora's box, because it's actually the opposite of Pandora's box. You are opening up a treasure trove, in my opinion, of great information here. But you also have a third book, Lost Horizon. And that one also is intriguing to me, because it delves into the phenomenal mystery teachings of the great Gnostic masters. I am always fascinated by what I like to refer to as the ancient wisdom teachings, which encompasses whatever you want it to encompass. You know, it's not defined. But physics seems to be right there at the forefront, on the table for people. They want to know more about it. Maybe that's one of the reasons why Big Bang Theory is a big hit. I don't know. I like it, but I found from a physicist that everything they talk about there, it's spot on. You don't have to worry.
Well, you know, quantum physics is that branch of science that really overlaps a lot of spiritual questions that have to do with origins, creations, energy, and so forth. And light is a very interesting subject. And the one thing we have to remember about light is that the visible light that we see is only a small spectrum of light energy. It's a small spectrum that's visible to the senses, but it's a blip on the screen compared to what lies on either end, the invisible energy that lies on either end. So light itself actually it's a force. And it's an intelligent force. It carries directive intelligence. And we know that from a number of sources dating back through ancient times, where they used to say that light, the light of God, and incidentally we hear in churches, both mainstream and alternative churches, that God is light. It becomes a little bit of a cliche, so that people, it's one of those things that people hear and they think they know what it means, but they really don't. The ancients were very precise. The ancient sages, particularly the Gnostics, were very precise about light. And they said that light is organic. It's a living light. And they said deity is discourse. Now, deity is discourse means that light can convey information to you. Discourse, when you discourse with somebody, you have a conversation, in effect, which means you're conveying information back and forth. So they're saying that the light that they speak of which visible light is just a small spectrum of that, really is the intelligent DNA energetic DNA of all the universe and creation, and it contains instructions essentially that form and shape the material world. Now, the ancients said this thousands of years ago, and of course this is an exact reflection of what modern science is telling us. And we have some amazing quotes that came from people like Max Planck, who's the father of quantum physics, and Albert Einstein, who really was the master of relativistic physics, the physics of very large-scale objects. And Planck said that essentially all creation is the function of an intelligent mind that's binding everything together in a matrix. Now, this is from the father of quantum physics. this is predating the movie by the same name by many, many years, but he's using the same terms, matrix, a network of intelligence and information. And then Albert Einstein said, we've all been wrong. What we think of as matter is merely light vibrating at a lower state so as to be perceptible to the senses. So essentially what quantum physics found out at the turn of the 20th century was that when they looked at the most basic elements of matter in the subatomic world, there were no such things as particles. Now, that's an astonishing statement, because we were all taught to believe that particles are the very things that form the basis of our so-called solid world. But at the very most fundamental levels of reality, these particles, they don't exist. What exists are waves of light. And these waves of light contain all possibilities. So think of these waves of light essentially as floating blueprints for reality. They contain all the information that forms the reality that we know, but we only choose a spectrum of that to fall into actual material particle existence. And human consciousness has very much to do, our choices and our beliefs have very much to do with collapsing these light waves into point particles to form what we call the material world. And they've done some very fascinating experiments one of them was called the double slit experiment, where they've actually shown that human observation actually affects these light waves and has the ability to collapse them into particle form. So human consciousness is actually a bridge or a tuning fork that takes this light energy in effect, and it can transmute it, or it translates it into what we view as the material world. So there really wouldn't be a reality, a physical reality, without the human mind out there, without human consciousness out there.
Well, and you've raised two interesting points that I want to pursue. And the first one has to do with my mantra when things aren't going the way that I would like them. I have to utter, sometimes low to myself, but sometimes in my mind, it's not real. It's an illusion. Even the ancient wisdom teachings tell us the same thing, that this real world is Maya. It's an illusion. It isn't real. But the other aspect that I wanted to touch upon, you said it's human consciousness that forms the light waves into the particles, into the solid matter, which is the chair I'm sitting in and the phone that you're talking on. So in that context, Peter, who is coming off as a physicist to me, what is consciousness? And I don't mean define what consciousness is in the context of what light is, what matter is, what have they come up with as what is consciousness?
To try and give you the Reader's Digest version and make it very simple without getting into very lengthy and complex explanations, the easiest way to put this is that consciousness is the source and substance of all there is. It is everything. It forms the basis of all energy and all physical matter. Consciousness is a vibration. It is a force. It expresses itself in the form of light. So essentially, light is the vehicle for conveying consciousness. Consciousness is directed thought. Light is the vehicle for conveying this directed thought. And matter is the end result of both working together. Matter is the end result of consciousness and light working together. So if you want to put a ladder, consciousness precedes everything. Light derives from consciousness, and matter derives from both consciousness and light.
Okay, and I do understand that. The one thing that I haven't been able to understand is the difference between, I can only put it in this context, regular physics and quantum physics. I thought the old physics was just fine. I've never been able to. And then you mentioned relativistic physics.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to understand. I never went to a physics class in my life, but I'm certainly learning a lot about physics, not only through you, but through this program and through others as well. And I know that a lot of people, they don't want to learn about physics. I still the one scene in that television series where the physicist is explaining to the girl what physics is. He starts back in Greece in whatever the year was. And it's like, we don't want to go back that far. We just would like to have a basic understanding of what is it that we're talking about when we're talking about physics. And I guess it's we're talking about everything. It is, we're talking about the physical world and how it relates to, shall we say, the unphysical world.
Well, let me there's a lot of questions in that last statement, so let me break it down into two parts. Number one, why people should be interested in physics and why physics is interesting. And number two, what are the differences within physics itself?
Okay.
Why everyone should be interested and why physics is interesting is this. The ancient spiritual sages always told us that there are three ways to contact divine knowledge. In other words, to enlighten ourselves to the point where we are in direct contact with divine information, information coming from a higher source or a higher plane. And those three ways are, number one, through our meditational practice, through prayer and meditation. Number two, through the reading of scriptures, in other words, understanding the compilations and writings of the sages and holy people throughout history. And the third is observation of the natural world, which is what science is. So in order for us to have the best grasp, or for a really well-rounded grasp, you know, we could do either one approach or the other, but using all three of them is really a powerful tool. And essentially that's what my work does, because when I go out and I talk around the country and I give my presentation on quantum spirituality, what I tell them is that, number one, this is the result of my own perceptions, my own deep meditations, a voracious amount of reading and study into ancient spiritual scripture and science. So I use all three, essentially, I use all three approaches, because when you are able to understand a subject matter from different angles, and think of them as different camera viewpoints, okay, you know how you have a film, and the great thing about film is you can see it from the front, from the back, from the side, you get different angles even simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I'm talking about here. You can take these three approaches and use them, and it becomes a very, very powerful tool for understanding things that could be rather complex, and it makes that understanding easier when you can see it from different points of view. And science and the observation of the natural world certainly is a very valid way to begin to trace back creation and begin to understand some of the deeper questions of life. Because you know that physics, you've probably seen it on the pop TV shows, on the science channels and everything else, they deal with these questions of the Big Bang, the origin of the universe, speculations on how human life started, so forth and so on. So that's one reason why people who are of a spiritual orientation probably would be well served to learn, you know, the basic rudimentaries of physics. And I'm not talking about mathematical formulae and things like that, but the main theories and concepts, at least as they dovetail with you know, deeper spiritual and philosophical issues. Now, the second part of the question, which is, what are the different types of physics?
Mm-hmm.
Basically speaking, we have classical physics and we have quantum physics. Classical physics was most associated with Isaac Newton and other people of his era. And classical physics works very well in describing the visible world. But where classical physics totally breaks down is when you get into the microscopic levels, the subatomic levels, where reality and things operate completely opposite almost from what we view in the physical world. So the ironic thing about it is that the world that we live in seems to operate according to certain laws, and yet the world that creates that, the layer of reality underneath it, seems to be going in the opposite direction. Half the things that, you know, most of the things that you see in quantum physics are very, very counterintuitive to things that take place in the gross or macroscopic world. Now, you also have relativistic physics, which is a little bit more related to classical physics in the sense that relativistic physics is the physics of large visible bodies. So it's usually associated with Albert Einstein because he came out with the most formative theories of relativity and how objects relate to each other, mass objects and gravitational fields and things like that. So Einstein really sort of concentrated on the macroscopic world, the world of visible phenomena, planetary scale things, whereas other physicists like Max Planck or Niels Bohr, who were quantum physicists, they concentrated on at the subatomic level. And the two branches have some trouble gelling with each other. There's particularly over the issue of gravity, which I won't get into now, but they can't really explain how gravity jives between the quantum world and the macroscopic world. There's some disconnect there that scientists have been arguing over, but we don't really need to get into that for our purposes,
right?
Because the type of physics that I'm talking about is intelligible, it can be understood by the average layperson, it doesn't have to get into complex mathematical formulae. When we're able to give analogs to these theories like the holographic universe theory, parallel dimensions, the Big Bang, all these different theories of origin, we can really explain them in layman's terms and then relate them to spiritual ideas and spiritual precepts that have been around for thousands of years.
Well, all of this stuff is just, I love the conversations that I get into because I learn so much, but the conversation is so interesting because it is about both the real and the unreal world, or the invisible world, if you will. One of the other areas that we are talking about in 2014 as we get there is going to have to do with another aspect of The Descent of Light, one of your ebooks, and that has to do with the meaning of archetypes and their basis for new paradigms of reality, right up my alley, because we're talking about mythology. We're talking about those stories that we have hung on to for years, centuries, eons, for all we know. But even the more modern mythology, a friend of mine back in the 90s during the Star Trek Next Generation series when it was airing, he said that his perception was that was our modern day mythology. So I start watching this series from that context. And I'm going, wow, that says a lot. I mean, because what is a myth or these stories? They're not just a story with characters, but they're also a story with a message, a moral sometimes, that kind of thing. And they're there to sort of teach us maybe how to be better people, better humans, and so forth. Let's talk I'm sorry.
Yeah, the whole subject of archetypes is very important for understanding reality, because the reason why myths, and a lot of people look at the word myth in the wrong way, they have a misunderstanding. They think of myth as just these fantastic tales,
right?
Of creatures that just can't possibly be, and heroes that just can't possibly do the things they're doing. But myths, in many ways, are probably the highest form of truth we possess, because in a symbolic way, in a way that's very hard to describe in other terms, myths bring into play eternal truths that vibrate at a level that may be just, in many cases, below our consciousness and our subconscious minds, and they come out through these less conscious layers, and they emerge as truths or guides for us. But the whole idea of archetypes has been around for many, many centuries. Plato talked about archetypes, and Plato said that the world of archetypal forms is more real than the reality that we perceive, because the reality that we perceive, physical reality, is based on those world of archetypal forms. Now, we have a modern counterpart to what Plato said in people like Carl Jung and, well, let me give you an example. Back in the early 1950s, there were two very famous men, Carl Jung, who was the founder of modern depth psychology, and a Nobel Prize-winning physicist named Wolfgang Pauli. And both of these men, who were outstanding scientists of their time, were driven together to communicate by very vivid dreams of alternate realities they were having. And they were seeking to understand this, so they collaborated. They met at Jung's house in Küsnacht, Switzerland, a couple of times, and then they communicated by mail over several years. And what they said was that there is a dimension, it's another dimension of very real blueprints or forms. They called it the psychoid world, or the unus mundus, the unifying world. And they said that this world is neither spirit nor matter, but both. In other words, it's a bridgeway where these archetypal images dwell. And these images that are almost, you could say, preordained forms or existing energetic blueprints of everything that we know in the physical world reside in this psychoid or this archetypal dimension. And that we, through our various senses or extra senses, intuitive senses in particular, and imagination, we perceive these archetypal images and we bring them back in the form of stories or other means of communicating them to our fellow human beings. And the interesting thing about these archetypes is that they're not just specific to any one culture. These archetypal blueprints, in effect, these archetypal images, are evident in all the cultures that we find in the world. They may express them in different stories and different forms, but they're describing the same archetypes. And that goes back to a very simple precept of the early shamanic era of our existence prior to 12,000 BC. And the shamans simply said, okay, there's two worlds that exist side by side. There's the physical world, and there's the unseen world. There's the energetic or the spirit world. And the shamans were those who were able to cross over between the world. They were able to bring back information from the spiritual side or the energetic dimension, and they were able to guide people in our physical dimension here. So the shamans were those that understood that there are different vibrating dimensions that exist parallel to one another, and that these archetypal images or blueprints that give us this guiding information reside in this other dimension, and they were able to tap into those and bring them back. Now, often they would bring them back in the form of healing, but later on when we had writing, they would develop myths. Because if you've ever had, for anybody out there that's ever had a really deep spiritual experience, a deep spiritual vision, or has had actual contact with divine information, try and explain that to somebody in regular words. It's just very, very hard to do. And then if you extrapolate that out and you're trying to explain your prophetic experience to a mass audience, then it's almost impossible. So the way the ancient sages used to express their truth was to develop these mythological stories. And in the mythological stories, the heroes, the people, the events, the narrative of the story contained these symbolic images that represented these archetypes. And in that way, everybody could read them at different levels. So someone might not get so much out of them. Another person who was a little bit more clued in would get more out of it. But this was essentially their way of communicating what sometimes is almost not communicable.
I think communicatable is okay. I think it'll work.
Whatever.
Well, on that note, we're going to take a little break, and we're going to talk more with Peter Canova. Pope Annalisa is his earlier work, and we're going to talk a little bit about that and where it has transpired to. Also talk more about the ebooks that are available at his website, popeannalisa.com. Children of a Greater God. Love that title. A Descent of Light and Lost Horizon. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan with Peter Canova, and we're talking about, I mean, just a lot of neat stuff. I'm so intrigued when I have a guest who is, he's quite diverse on the one hand in the knowledge that he has and that he brings to us, and at the same time, and I have to say that, Peter, I had an interesting conversation some time ago with Greg Braden. I'm sure you know him as well. And
yeah,
he had somebody come up to him and say, talking about his book, saying, you know, could you just write about one thing? I mean, all these books about all these different things. And I said, I don't know where they're coming from, because from my perspective, they're all connected. I mean, it's more of an evolution, if you will, as he's written. And it's the same thing with you. And I think that that's with all of us. We're all just trying to understand I love somebody said to me years ago when I was asking all kinds of questions, similar to what I do now. But they said, why don't you just leave some questions unanswered for the next life, meaning the hereafter, not so much, being reincarnated into a new life. And I thought, well, that's all fine, well and good. But I'm still curious. I still want to know the answers to these things.
Well, once you really and truly understood that everything is a unity, it's very hard for you just to describe the part. I know Greg has the same issue that I do. It's kind of like the story of the Hindu story of the blind men and the elephant,
yes.
Where, they have like nine blind men and they're all positioned at different parts of the elephant. And of course they can't see. So their perception is limited. So they feel, one feels the tail and he thinks it's the whole reality. The other feels the trunk and he feels it's the whole reality. The other feels a leg and he thinks it's the whole reality. When of course the elephant is a totality. So, we tend, particularly in the Western world, to analyze and divide things. I mean, to analyze means to break things up. So that's sort of like the typical Western left brain thinking, which is analytical thinking, which is breaking the whole into parts. Now, sometimes that's useful, but what I find more useful is to reconstitute the parts into the whole to allow people to sort of understand the whole continuum and the totality of things, because then I think our eyes are more fully open. So it's sometimes very hard to, and these subjects are so complex sometimes that, you sort of have to at some point cut it off and divide it up. But the temptation's always there to kind of, sort of lay it out in a whole continuum.
Well, and sometimes for some of us, it needs to be cut up into little pieces so that we can digest it a little bit better. I think one of the greatest words that I ever came across while reading Stranger in a Strange Land was the word to grok. The word grok is not just to know. It's even beyond what I'm about to say, to assimilate into every cell of your being the knowledge and understanding of that which you are, say, observing or trying to, quote unquote, understand. And I know that because of the circles that you travel in, shall we say, hobnobbing, if you will, with some of the great minds in this arena. Who are also trying to understand. Nobody has claimed, and you haven't claimed this either, that you have all the answers. And I love that because it gives the rest of us an opportunity maybe to find some. But I use this analogy, Peter. The universe, let's just say, for the sake of argument, has 10,000 laws. Man has discovered 10 and thinks he knows it all. The following year, he discovers number 11 and says, oh, and now we know it all. And I think that's where a lot of people get frustrated with science and physics and all these things, because people come across so dogmatically about this information as if it's the end all and be all, and we have reached the conclusion, and yet we're still here.
I think that's a fantastic point, Richard, because when I, very frequently when I give my talks, I say to everybody, don't take what I'm giving you as the absolute truth, because I'm not sure that we in these material forms can ever realize absolute truth, that we have a series of revelations of partial truths. And as we move, and it doesn't necessarily mean that we were wrong earlier, but it means that we had a more limited perception. So if you want to take a view of a valley and a mountain, and you are down at the foot of the valley and you're seeing a certain panorama, when you move higher up the mountain, you see more of the picture, you see more of the panorama. And the higher you go up, the more you see. Now, does that mean what you saw down below was wrong? No, it just means that you were just seeing a small portion of it. And I think that creates the humility in me anyway, because every time, I used to think that I'd really discover this ultimate truth, it would soon be superseded by a new truth. And like everybody else, I think we're explorers along a path, and that we're always going to discover things. And it's kind of like the difference between spirituality and religion. And the analogy I always give to people is that if you view your spiritual growth as you're traveling along a path or a highway, and along that highway there are these way stations, and you stop in the way station and essentially, you pick up your knowledge and you kind of get regenerated there. Now, religion will say, okay, we've got all the answers. We've got the be-all and end-all here, which is the dogmatic approach, so stay here and punch your ticket and stay within these four walls. That's the religious approach. But the spiritual approach would be, okay, thank you, I've really learned something here, but now I'm moving on to the next way station. So you've got to keep spirituality is more open-ended. It leaves the open possibility that life and spiritual growth is a journey and it's a constant revelation, as opposed to a dogmatic boxing in of your efforts and your knowledge into just a certain circumscribed type of arena where you're not going to grow any further. And that's when people tend to become very rigid and everything else. So you have to keep your spirituality open-ended and always understand that a newer, higher perception could be just around the corner for you or for humanity. And you're right, but even people in the spiritual circuit, a lot of times, they kind of speak, and I don't know if they're doing it on purpose or if they just sort of get so excited about where they're at that they tend to forget that, you know, where they're at is not the be-all and end-all. It sort of comes off sometimes like, you know, I've got the answers here. Mm. But if anybody ever tells you that they have all the answers, run from them as fast as you can, because you're with the wrong person.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think, too, that was one of the reasons why I traveled in the circles that I did in my early spiritual life, because I was curious. And the strange thing was, there weren't that many people in the crowd I was around, because the people that I associated with through the religious station that I was with, I had problems with the some of the conclusions that they came to. It's like it just did not make sense in my mind. And so I continued to ask all of these different questions. And that's one of the things that I'm so intrigued by. In regards to this third book, Lost Horizons, I know it's dealing primarily with the great Gnostic masters, but it also deals with Jesus and a more sophisticated spiritual message that I think in some instances, the people, I'm going to say closer to the bottom, who are the messengers, who got caught up in their own self-importance, began to just repeat these stories that they learned. I'm not saying that they took from the writings, and just said, no, this is what I know, and this is the way it is. And they led others down that same path away from what could be considered the real truth. I mean, I always got so frustrated when I would hear the biblical passage, "Ye shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free." And I did my own word search and my own concordance and realized that the word truth was not the good news of the gospel of Jesus Christ. It was whatever the truth was supposed to be, whatever was true. If you knew it, if you understood it, if you grokked it, you were free. I would even go to this extent, Peter. If I knew the truth about a particular part of my past that maybe I blocked out due to trauma and what have you, that as soon as I got in touch with that, and that was real. In other words, it really did happen, but I blocked it, you know, out of self-preservation. And now as an adult, I can understand it. I can put it in its proper perspective. I now know the truth. My gosh, I can breathe a sigh of relief and I can move on with the rest of my life. I'm not carrying that baggage anymore. To me, that is a part of knowing the truth about self.
Well, yeah, and what you really said was that, as the key thing that you said was that if you could now look back on it as an adult, you could process it and integrate it, whereas before it would just overwhelm you. So that's probably why things get suppressed. The difference between knowledge and faith is that knowledge, as it was talked about amongst the Gnostics, and Gnostics comes from the Greek verb gnosin, which means to know, gnosin and know. Knowledge didn't mean intellectual knowledge, it meant experiential knowledge. Mm-hmm. So it was the difference between someone telling you that fire burns and you putting your hand in the fire and feeling it. And so knowledge supersedes faith, because faith is something that you take on the word of somebody else, whereas knowledge is a direct experience that you have. And in this case, if we're talking about a direct experience with divine information or divine contact, when it happens to you, you know it. It's so vivid, and it pictures itself out in the material world such that you know that it's not a function of imagination, although imagination is very necessary. But it's a transformative experience that some people have. It's the light bulb moment, things enlighten, and you know your life just changes, which is what happened to me and converted me from an international businessman to what I'm doing today. It changed my whole life around. The whole purpose of everything we do, I really think, is to ultimately have that contact with our higher selves, with ourselves. And I really do believe that when we talk about, you know, our guiding spirits and all these other things, we're really, in many ways, talking about meeting ourselves at a higher level, because we're chains of being that extend from a light realm of pure information, and we've descended in vibration down here in order to have the feeling of a material experience. But our true selves are not these bodies. These bodies are just symbiotes that we live in, that our spirit lives in order to have a material experience. Our true selves really come from this world of light and this world of light energy and knowledge. So, you know, it's really important to get back to that point, because ultimately, we're lost in this dream. And it's, you mentioned the Star Trek series. What the thing
Next
was
Generation.
About? Yeah, Next Generation. Well, the thing that was most brilliant about that to me was the holodeck.
Yeah.
And the holodeck, essentially, was where the crew would go into this place and immerse themselves in this virtual reality that was so real that sometimes you could get lost in it. And that essentially, that's what the holographic universe theory and what the ancient spiritual texts are telling us, is that we have dreamed ourselves from a state of pure consciousness into these physical forms. And we began to identify reality with the boundaries of our skin over time, because we've forgotten the true vibration that we descended from. But that's what Lost Horizon is really about. And the thing is that you have, from time to time, you have spiritual masters like Jesus who incarnate onto the earth plane. And the thing is that prophets speak the heart of God, but their followers start religions. Because it's the prophet who actually has the direct contact with the divine and the divine experience, and they then have to somehow communicate that and put it into words. As soon as they put it into words, the followers who have not had the experience don't completely understand, so they have to interpret. And as soon as they start interpreting, they bring in their own prejudices and agendas. And as soon as they bring in their own prejudices and agendas, they create vested interest where they have to defend their version of what they're saying. So that is that's the whole process of how every spiritual revelation ultimately gets corrupted by degrees and over time to the point where it goes from pure information to dogmatic understanding.
Well, I think that also is sort of epitomized, too, by, as you talk about, the difference between knowledge and faith, that experience. My mother asked me some years ago if I'd ever had any supernatural or spiritual experiences, you know, like what we had been talking about. And I said, well, it's kind of hard for me to define, because I kind of take the perspective that maybe Jesus did, that the things that he did were normal to him. So, yeah. You know, if I've had them, I wouldn't call them that, because they didn't stand out in that fashion. And maybe
it's not like Hollywood, where all of a sudden you have flashes of light and trumpets and, you know, fireworks go off. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, well, I have to say, too, that there's a part of me that wishes that I was able to compartmentalize it in that way and say, oh, yeah, this happened, and I remember that because, et cetera, et cetera. I just, you know, nothing comes to mind. I consider myself a very fortunate individual, that I feel as though I've been in the right place at the right time in many instances. There have been others when I'm wondering, how did I get here? But, of course, we all go through that. I want to remind our listeners, we're talking with Peter Canova. He's the author of Pope Annalisa, as well as three other ebooks that are available on the website, popeannalisa.com. Children of a Greater God. The reason I like that title is because us, because yours and my awareness and our understanding of God is probably similar, Peter, in that we're not looking for a centenarian with a long beard and a hook or a staff who's controlling things.
Yeah.
That I used to say to people that I did not create myself, as far as I know, and I don't know. I mean, the things that I read, and I'm rereading my Metaphysical Primer, Autobiography of a Yogi. The things that I read in regards to where we came from and where we're going to are the same place. And so I begin to process that, going, well, maybe I did create myself.
Yes. Yeah, we all contributed to creating ourselves, because what you really have to understand is that the whole idea of physical creation is a descent of light, and that light essentially, let me back up, because this is where it gets hard for some people to understand about the very basis of creation. If you accept the proposition that God is everything all at once, in other words, omnipresent, omniscient, which most of the sages of the past do believe that, then you have to think that how can something that is everything become a something? In other words, how can individuality occur,
yeah,
if this being that we call God is so all-encompassing that it pervades it pervades everything? How can something exist outside of that whole? Well, it's a paradox, because there's really only one way that can happen, and that is for the whole to begin to forget itself, to begin to forget it's the whole. So the whole process of creation, as it was described in the ancient text, was God flinging its light essence, its consciousness, out into separate stages where it would forget a little bit more about itself at each stage. So it would create different levels of consciousness. So consciousness with a big C, which is God, created consciousness with a small C, which is different levels of both spiritual and material entities. And it was kind of like the rungs of a ladder descending down. And the further away this light projected from the source, this consciousness projected from the source, the more it would become unconscious of its wholeness, to the point where the lowest form is here in physical existence, where we see ourselves not only as separate minds with free will, but we see ourselves as separate bodies, and everything has the appearance of separation. We have almost the total appearance of separation at this level of creation, even though that's only an illusion, because we're still part of that light continuum. We've only made ourselves so ignorant that we don't perceive it. So to really have individuality, the precondition for individuality was a certain degree of forgetfulness or ignorance. Because if we weren't ignorant and we had cosmic consciousness, we wouldn't be sitting here having a human experience. We'd be back up at some other realm, essentially at the throne of God. We would be, you know, part of that God consciousness, be more conscious of being God than being ourselves. We have an intellectual concept of God here, but we don't really have that Gnostic experience of truly being one, with everything. Except when you do have that enlightened experience, then that's why it's so transformative. You now transcended the illusion of individuality, and you climb back up the ladder closer to the source, so you understand the source for what it is. So, you know, if you look at yourself as the product of this descending ladder, you exist at different levels of consciousness. What you call Richard and what I call Peter in this earthly plane, we have a whole chain of being that extends back up, that are really parts of ourselves that have descended down here in consciousness. And we contribute in the light continuum, in the river of life, in the river of creation. At each level, we contribute something of our thought, our belief, our energy into that. So yes, in that manner, we are creations of ourselves to a certain extent.
Yeah, it's again, it's one of those mind-bending, what's the phrase? Difficulty wrapping one's brain around it, or it around one's brain, because it's much larger than one's brain. But I have to say that one of my favorite comedians, Lewis Black, I love the way he pronounces the word illusion. and all of this is an illusion. And I read in the ancient texts as well about duality. And I got into a conversation with somebody the other day about this, and I said, if we're coming from the oneness and we're going back to the oneness, what's this duality business down here? Why are we doing this? What is the point? I mean, my gosh, if we were the one, why did we need these experiences? If we were all that ever was, you know, and why did we need to split ourselves up into these individual pieces of what I like to call, we're pieces of the great hologram in the sky, so to speak. That has been the perplexing question. It's not the same as why are we here? Okay. It's why the duality? If there's light, then there's just light, you know?
Well, again, this could be one of the most deepest questions of life, and I'm going to give you I'm not going to cop out. I'm going to give you an answer.
Okay.
And I will tell you I'm not going to tell you it's the absolute truth, but I'll tell you that it's the answer that I've come to from years of meditation and years of reading, and I'm sure other people may have other answers, but this is the closest that I can come in as an intellectual concept to answer your question to make it intelligible to the listeners for something that's such a deep question. The state of being is not the same as the state of experiencing. If, as quantum physics and as ancient spiritual texts tell us, that there is a level of being out there that is all-encompassing, it's everything, it can be aware of itself, but that doesn't necessarily mean it can experience. If you encompass everything there is, how do you sort of have an experience outside of yourself? Because you can only experience in terms of something in relation to yourself. So that's where duality arises. In the effort of the Supreme Being, of the Supreme Consciousness, to experience and reflect upon itself, it needed something else to reflect upon it. And it split itself up, essentially. This is where the fragmentation of light and consciousness occurred, and the whole creation occurred, as a way for God to create these little mirrors to experience itself throughout all the levels of creation. So that's why I say that we're not humans having a spiritual experience, we're spirits having a human experience. And our purpose on this world is to be as the fingers of God touching the face of this world, to spiritualize the material, but also to bring the experience of the material back to spirit, so that energy can understand what it was like to exist in physical form, have the feeling of sunlight hitting your skin, of touching other people, of having these experiences. These are things that a state of being would not happen in a state of being. It could only happen in a state of actual experiencing. And that experiencing, of course, is done through smoke and mirrors, as we've discussed, through a form of illusion.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, it is a form of experience.
But doesn't that imply that there was something lacking in the all-pervasive consciousness of the universe that it needed or wanted, doesn't matter, needed or wanted, to have the experiences? It says that something was missing in its life or its existence, that it couldn't get any other way. So it, in order to fulfill this need, this is what it did. It split itself up into these little mirrors.
Well, I think that's a matter of perception. That's like, you know, glass half full or glass
okay.
half empty. I mean, to me, I would look the opposite way, you know, and say, you know, no, it didn't mean there was something lacking. It meant that there was an expression of fullness of expressing energy in the whole fullness of all possibility, you know. And so I wouldn't necessarily describe it in terms of it happened because of a lack, but it happened because of an expression to spread, you know, this energy throughout every type of experience that we could possibly have. So, you know, your question implies kind of a matter of perception. It depends on what point of view you want to look at it from.
Okay. I'll take that and we'll continue to move forward. Like I say, I find these programs really interesting because You just don't know where they're going to go. And I'm hoping that they're entertaining as well as informative to our listeners, who can get more information about you and Pope Annalisa, the latest work, the multiple award-winning novel by my guest, Peter Canova. You can also find out about his three e-books, Children of a Greater God, A Descent of Light, and Lost Horizon. They're also available through Annalisa, PopeAnnalisa.com. Speaking of Pope Annalisa, it is being made into a movie. I'm real excited about that. I can hardly wait for that to come out. What can you tell us about that process?
Yeah, I can tell you it's a very interesting process. Just getting into the whole film world in Hollywood right now, I'm getting immersed in that. Well, Pope Annalisa was fortunate enough to win its 10th literary award.
Wow.
A couple months ago. This time was Writer's Digest Award, which is a highly competitive one. And yes, I did sign a co-production deal with the Phoenix Pictures people that did Black Swan, which won an Oscar a couple of years ago. And right now we have finished the script and we're into the budgeting and scheduling phase, where we give the script over to an expert and they take a look at it and they essentially, you know, say, okay, here's how much it's going to cost, and here's how we schedule the production and so forth. So we're still in the early stages of it right now. You won't be seeing this movie out next year, at any rate, because after we finish all the budgeting, we then have to go out and raise the money, which is the toughest part. And it's an epic length. It's an epic novel.
Oh, so, yeah.
You know, it's not going to be an inexpensive film, and we're hovering somewhere between a studio and an independent film figure right now, and we're kind of on the cusp where, you know, you can retain better control as independents, but it's also a little harder to raise money. Whereas studio, it's easy to raise money, but you have less control. So we're going to be going through that very interesting process right there, trying to figure out the best way to go, and we may end up with a hybrid. But we'll be putting that together, and I wish I could give you an exact date, but you really can't, because it depends on how the money flows in. What I will tell you, though, is that Pope Annalisa has really caught on with a lot of people in Hollywood. I think people are looking to take the higher road now, and, you know, the kind of blood and guts films and you know, kind of mind candy action adventure films that we see nowadays. There's a lot of people out there that are kind of getting fed up with that, and they're saying, you know what, we're really looking for an interesting story, for an action and adventure and a mystery story like Pope Annalisa is, mm-hmm. but by the same token, something that really carries a message that can be valuable to humanity. So it's catching fire with a certain visionary group in Hollywood, and I think that really bodes well to get the film on screen at some point, because these are powerful people, and I think that if they get their names and they get their efforts behind this process, that will be successful. I am meeting shortly with some people to also talk about doing it as a mini-series on TV, or kind of along the lines of a, you know, Game of Thrones or a Boardwalk Empire or something like that, which actually I kind of like that, because I think we can get the story out better in you know, 12, 13 segments or over a two-year period than we could trying to cram it into a feature film. But it's going to be an interesting process to see where it goes. But I think the good thing is, like I say, people like the material.
Mm-hmm.
People in Hollywood understand it the way your listeners would probably understand it if they read it, because there's, believe it or not, there is a spiritual orientation in Hollywood itself, even though it doesn't always seem to come out on the screen.
Yeah. Well, I think I'd lean more towards the multi-part series. I actually have, because of the fact that we are no longer hooked up to network television and what have you, we use the on-demand services that are available now, that I've seen things that I would have never seen before. I did not know that there was a series called Titanic that came out right around the 100th anniversary of the sinking, among other things as well. And when I've watched some of these other series that I've come across that only had maybe 6 or 7 or 8 episodes, that's all that they made, because that's all they needed. And so it was like, oh, great, I get to watch this and I get to see it come to a conclusion, as opposed to a series that was on for maybe 7 or 8 or 9 episodes and then was canceled, and so there was no resolution of any of the issues in that
right.
regard. That's one of the things that I love about the new the new television, if you will, entertainment venues. Kind of like it went along the same lines as the music industry did when the internet took off in the 90s, that I don't want to just hear the one or two songs off of the 45 that you're telling me are number one. What else is on that album that they did? So that's what's exciting to me about the innovations that have come about. And I'm real excited. I'm sure you're probably more excited than I am about seeing how this will eventually look on the screen. I will tell you that when I read, for example, when I read, because I haven't finished Pope Annalisa yet, but when I read, for example, Dan Brown's books, the movie was running in my head so that when I actually saw the movie on the screen, I'm going, did this guy tap into my head? Because even though I didn't pick specific actors to play specific characters, Tom Hanks looked like the guy that he was portraying. And these kinds of things, it's like my imagination just goes nuts inside my head. And I just so I'm like, will this look like and not that I really care that much, but it's just astounding when that does happen. So I'm very excited for you and everybody involved in this process. And we look forward maybe in 2015, 2016. Hey, when it comes out and we'll be thrilled.
I do think that if this ever does make it to the screen in one form or another, I think it's going to be a real cultural transformer, because one thing that the work really does is some works have a tendency to be able to kind of bring out what's on the just beneath people's consciousness.
Yeah.
And I think there's so many issues in Pope Annalisa that people will have a light bulb moment with saying, yeah, I kind of felt that. I kind of knew that. And, you know, it kind of chronicles the growth of this feminine energy that's recycling back into our lives to make us more intuitive, more imaginative people, which really is the gateway to opening up these higher perceptions. It's moving from, you know, purely left brain thinking into more integrated left brain, right brain thinking, where we use all of our faculties, both the analytical and logical side and the intuitive and the imaginative side, to become sort of superior human beings. And I think that's really where we're headed. I think that's what the whole 2012 hoopla was about, that, you know, it's this energy that's coming back to balance us out. And then, you know, we're gonna propel light years once we start to do this. And I think Pope Annalisa kind of chronicles the movement and all the work, the trilogy chronicles the whole movement of that energy coming back to recycle into our lives.
Well, I'm just excited for when it does eventually make it to the big or small screen. Doesn't matter to me. I'll watch it because I'm just intrigued by the story in and of itself. And I'm really grateful for the time that you've given us here on the program to talk about all these different things. And I'm not sure if I asked you these questions near the end of our last get together, but I will now. Who is Peter Canova?
I was a former luxury hotel developer not too long ago, and I had earlier in my life, in my 20s, I had a series of very vivid experiences that led me to understand that there was definitely an alternate reality out there, and I spent most of my life trying to understand that, both from studying and from my own channeling experiences, and it really led me to a career where I wanted to impart the information that I'd learned to other people, and I hope that in doing so it can help them reach a point in their own spiritual practice that propels them along their path of growth. And you know, really very simply, that's what I'm trying to do. I could embellish it with a lot more interesting stories about some of my past experiences in different parts of the world, but we probably don't have enough time for that.
Well, we'll actually have you back again because I would love to pursue those stories. I think that they give a great insight into who and what Peter Canova is all about and where the works that he is bringing forth are coming from. And to that end, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Well, as I said, my goal, pure and simple, is to provide people with a knowledge base that brings in both science and brings in spirituality, which brings in both subjective and objective experience, in order to create an arena of information for people, whatever level of consciousness they're at, to take this information and to use it in ways to better their lives, to improve their lives and help their own spiritual growth. Because I think in a lot of ways, what's great about this work is that there's so much in here that's intriguing. Even if somebody is not particularly spiritually oriented, there's so much in here that would whet their appetite and their curiosity that it may be the catalyst to get them to start looking in a different direction. And I really do believe, Richard, that when humanity all starts to look in a different direction and we pull away from the material a little bit and we start to really focus on the fact that, you know what, there may be another world out there and let me learn a little bit more about it. Those are the kind of baby steps that it takes to transforming the entire human race, to transforming everything that's happening on this planet, because really things happen where we focus our attention. At one time, we were totally focused on our own spirit. We were spiritual. Then we incarnated into the material, and our focus became on the material. Now we have to refocus back from where we came, and that's where we start to, I think, experience heaven on earth. When Jesus spoke about, you know, the kingdom of heaven and experiencing heaven on earth, I think that's what it really is. It's a realization while you're still in body, not after you pass away and you go to the heavenly realm. It's a realization while you're still embodied of your spiritual potential, and that you really do derive from, your reality derives from another place.
And are you optimistic about man's future here on this planet?
I am an eternal optimist. I am optimistic about our future. I think that there's a lot of people out there who are kind of preaching gloom and doom, and we have to understand that very often there's a monetary reason behind that, because it sells, kind of like negative news sometimes sells, you know, better than positive news, and that's why our newspapers are so full of negative stuff, and TV stations always report, you know, horrible stories all the time. But, no, I am very optimistic, because I just sense that there's a growing change just happening all around the world and in our... Well, I'll give you an example. I mean, I always tell this to people. They say, well, how do you measure consciousness, and how can you tell consciousness is really increasing or growing? And you can't graph that out. It's not something you can put in a computer or hook people up to a machine and say, oh, you know, you're experiencing higher consciousness. But there's anecdotal evidence out there that shows societal shifts in thinking. And one of the things that I always tell people is that I've been attending these holistic conferences like the Whole Life Expo or New Living Expo, Conscious Living Expo, those type of events, for 3 or 4 decades now, starting back in the late 60s. And when I was attending those, if there was a room full of 200 people, it would be like 199 women and me. Now, I speak at these events, and there's thousands of people there, and it's almost a 50-50 split. Now, what that tells me is that what I was speaking of before about this intuitive energy, this what we call the feminine energy that is recycling into our lives again, is a reality, because in a former time, just a few decades ago, all these type of things that you and I are talking about here would have been a little too out there or too touchy-feely for most guys.
Yeah.
But now, men as well as women who are more naturally intuitive are really seeking answers and finding answers to these things. And everything begins with the seeking, you see? When people start to seek, they start to learn. And when they start to learn, they start to grow. And you have to take those baby steps there. And I see us well along the way to doing that right now.
Well, it's very exciting, and I'm really grateful for you giving us as much time as you have here on the program to talk about this, as we are fast approaching the end of 2013 and heading towards 2014. And again, I look forward to talking with you again when you have another work in the mix, whether it be another book or Annalisa is coming to an entertainment center near you. So, Peter, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Richard. And let me say this. You're up there in Santa Barbara, is it?
Yes.
Which is one of my favorite towns. And it's one of the towns I have not spoken in yet, but I'll be working on that. So one of these days I hope to be up in that area actually talking to people.
That'd be great. We'll have you in studio for an in-studio interview.
Terrific.
Again, Peter Canova is my guest, and the book, the latest, or actually the earlier book, is Pope Annalisa, and the other three books, just to remind you, Children of a Greater God, A Descent of Light, and Lost Horizon, all available at popeannalisa.com. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.